ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello there, it's the Religion and Ethics Report. Andrew West with you, and it's election season. And later in the show, we're going to take you to an election where only about 140 people get to vote. It's the election of a new pope. A conclave begins soon, but even though it's a sacred election, so to speak, there's still politics. But before they choose a new pope, Australians will choose the next government. And as we do at every election, we're going to look beyond the day's headlines and ask where issues of religion, immigration, ethnicity and identity could be factors. We're here in Parramatta, just off a rather rainy square, because Western Sydney is one of several regions around Australia where the votes of multicultural communities could be decisive. And I don't think we could have chosen two better people to discuss these issues. Melissa Montero heads the Community Migrant Resource Centre here in Parramatta. She's also the author of the book, The Girl from Mumbai. And Professor Awais Paracha is a specialist in demography and urban planning at Western Sydney University. It's so good to have you both here.
Thank you.
Awais, let's start with you. Western Sydney is a big part of the story. It's not the only part of the story. Where across Australia could religious identity and religious observance play a role? It might not be the total role, but play some role in shaping people's voting decisions.
Yeah, I think the most obvious and most in headline case would be that of Muslim migrants. In Sydney, we have about 6% of the population who are Muslim. In Western Sydney, that's 10%. Everyone would have seen in the newspapers, they are very concerned about the situation in Gaza. That might influence their decision when it comes to voting. But I think they are still a very diverse community, and they will not vote as a monolith, in my opinion. If anyone is going to benefit from their voting, it's going to be the Greens, I suspect, from my interaction with them, which is very strange because Muslims are very conservative and wouldn't identify with some of the Green policies. They would have very different views on issues such as LGBTI or Green stance on drugs. But I think at the moment, because there is an element of emotion involved, they are probably going to give preference to Greens, at least some of them. But by no means they are unified. Some are preferencing Liberal to punish Labour. Some are voting for a few independent Muslim candidates from Muslim Vote Matters. And some would continue to vote for Labour, which is their traditional constituency.
Yeah. Not just in Sydney, though. You look at Melbourne and I think a bit of Brisbane too. Where is it relevant there?
So in Melbourne, so you have northern suburbs where large Muslim communities are found. There are divisions of Caldwell or the suburbs such as Craigieburn. They also have Muslim Vote Matters candidates. But even those candidates in Sydney, for example, in Blaxland and in Watson and the candidate in Caldwell are preferencing Greens as second on, or they are recommending that to the voters. So there may be a blip in this election and the Greens might get some more votes. But migrant communities have very similar aspirations and desires for everyday life, for practical matters. They are exactly the same as the broader Australian community.
Yeah. I'm going to come to you, Melissa, and I should just emphasise to the listeners, both our panel members are non-partisan. They are people who are deeply connected to their communities, but this is a non-partisan panel. Melissa, is there a distinct pattern to say how first and second generation multicultural communities vote in Australia?
Yes, I think there is a distinct pattern, especially with the second generation communities. The young people especially and the second and third generations will go away from what their forefathers or their parents have voted in the past, only because people today and especially the young people are making their own choices and making their own decisions. They're also subject to what's happening around the world because of technology and the TikTok with the internet things that we, our forefathers didn't have, or our parents and our first, you know, the other generations didn't have, the second generations are moving away and making their own minds.
Yeah. Let's say you're 25 from the subcontinent. What sort of issues would preoccupy you?
Employment is one of the very biggest issues for a young person today, finding employment and finding meaningful employment in Australia. Young people have the skills, but just need the opportunity. And we see that all the time, especially in the work that we do at the Resource Centre. And the most other, second most important one is the housing availability and affordability.
Yeah.
Young people have a dream, and they're here in Australia because of that dream, because of their own dream, or because of the dream of their parents.
Yeah. Awais, I mean, you teach young people yes. at Australia's most multicultural university. I think Western Sydney University yes. is the most ethnically and culturally diverse university in the country. What do you sense from your students about the issues that preoccupy them politically?
Migrant kids, if I may call them that, they are very much mainstream. So they listen to the same music, they consume the same social media, they have very similar concerns about their future professional lives and housing and cost of living and so on and so forth. For young people especially, they are influenced by social media like everybody else and would have a very diverse voting pattern.
And would that be social media? Because it's quite controversial, as you both know. Could that be social media from overseas?
It can
is,
be.
Is that language-specific social media? We hear a lot about Mandarin-speaking communities getting specific social media messages, Arabic-speaking communities getting their own social media messages. Is that happening?
It might be happening a bit, but I don't think that young people are so easily influenced. They are not silly. They understand what is important and what might be propaganda.
Yes, I tend to agree. I think young people are very, very tech savvy. They do get influenced. And as you call, this is the age of the so-called influencer. Mm. So young people are looking at influencers, but at the end of the day, they will make up their own minds.
Yeah.
Integration is another important, don't forget this element, where young people are wanting to just be part of the mainstream that Professor just spoke about. They don't want to be seen as different just because of their ethnic identities. They want to be part of a larger Australian community and just need that opportunity to do that.
Very interesting, Melissa. But Awais, aren't a lot of younger voters also quite conscious of their family heritage, where they're from? They're not keen to give up all sense of identity and family heritage, are they?
I will make 2 points here. One is they are doing that because there is a general acceptance in society of such differences, which probably didn't exist as much before. Also, they are very independent and they want freedom of thought and action. But having said that, I would say that Australia is both unifying and diversifying at the same time. Mm. So it's diversifying because we have migrants, non-white migrants. Largely 80% of migration in Australia these days is from various parts of Asia. There's that diversity, which is cultural and ethnic diversity. But at the same time, they are unifying because, as I said before, due to globalization, due to social media, they are consuming same social media, mainstream media. They have similar aspirations. We tend to worry too much about the diversity, the apparent superficial diversity, I would call. At the heart of it, I think we are quite unified.
Yeah. Melissa, just remind us, no one's better tapped into Western Sydney than you. At the Community Migrant Resource Centre, off the top of your head, how many nationalities would you deal with in a week?
In a week, we would have 26 to 30 different right. nationalities. But can I just change this conversation to give you the big picture for Western Sydney? Other than the housing, the employment, the skills recognition, there is a growing anti-Semitism. There are the two sides of communities where I feel our social cohesion is being tested like it has never yeah. been tested before. Let me talk about the two other issues that get sidelined and we don't really talk about it, but they're very key social health indicators like the diabetes. We're not talking about diabetes in Western Sydney.
There's diabetes.
Diabetes, yeah. Yeah. Yes.
So public health you're talking
public
about.
Public health, yeah. Exactly. Very important. Alcohol, drugs, mental health and domestic violence are the other issues that are growing in Western Sydney, in addition to the housing availability and the housing affordability and also the employment and the skills recognition. For me, I think this summarizes all of the issues that our migrant populations are facing in Western Sydney.
Awais, you are very concerned about community harmony. The last conversation we had was your concern about how the housing market was reinforcing elements of segregation. I mean, what's your concern there? Because that is fascinating, because I know that you are deeply concerned about harmony and cohesion.
In my research, I have discovered, and I argue, the resistance of affluent communities. In case of Sydney, that would be, it could be Melbourne also, inner city or affluent suburbs. In Sydney, they would be in the east or north. We are unable to build more housing there. But those are the locations where we have jobs, where we have accessibility to various amenities, and people can walk to them. The need to provide more transport is less. We are building so much more in the West. Actually, these days, if you visit Mount Druitt, it looks like Manhattan. So it is unbelievable, the sort of development that is taking place. Very tall apartment buildings in Schofield, in Granville, in Bankstown, Liverpool, Campbelltown, everywhere. Almost all population increase is taking place in those areas, migrant areas. And migrants don't have access to these good jobs, and they have to travel long distances, spend long time away from their families. That's not the best from the urban planning perspective, but also from the social cohesion perspective.
Yeah. This is the Religion and Ethics Report with Andrew West. It's a special pre-election program, and we're in Parramatta out here in the square. And you've just heard Professor Awais Paracha. He's an expert in demography and urban planning. And Melissa Montero, she heads the Community Migrant Resource Centre here in Parramatta. Let's talk about immigration. Because we're here in the heartland of first and second generation Australia, I get the feeling, though, that sometimes a message about immigration, maybe lowering immigration, as long as it's a question about numbers as opposed to composition, I get the feeling that it isn't always that controversial, Awais.
What I would like to highlight is that most migration these days is skilled migration. So we are getting lots of professionals who are highly educated, and they benefit Australia in various ways. And they are young, tend to be younger too, which is also beneficial because otherwise we are an aging society. Actually, if we did not have migration, Australia's population would be declining, and we would be aging much faster than what we are otherwise. Migrants fill gaps in the labor market. As far as the exact numbers are concerned, I don't think there is anyone in Australia who says we should stop migration altogether. It's just a matter of how much, and which is a subjective question. So.
Because I compare it to, quite frankly, some rather dark debates that were had in the 1980s about the places of origin. Mm. It seems to me now to be just a numbers game.
Yeah, actually, I think we have come a long way from the situation in 1980s. So there were these fringe political parties coming up and laning migrants. So Australia has accepted that we have a significant population in this country who are migrant, and they are serving the country as well as anybody else.
Melissa, has the immigration conversation changed?
Yes, the conversation is changing. I think people are recognizing more that having migrants coming in from other countries are only contributing to the economy in this country. People are now accepting. First, it was only government that was thinking. Now, people are realizing the value of having people from overseas. It's just more than the food. Mm. I think the cultural and the economic benefits, it's being seen as an advantage.
Let's talk about some social and cultural issues, because we know that from the results of referenda and of the same-sex marriage ballot, we know that in parts of Western Sydney, also parts of Western and Northern Melbourne, communities still hold fast to traditional values. Mm. Do communities feel under pressure to abandon their social and cultural values?
Yes, there is pressure for the second generation. They will be influenced in to a large extent by what their families and tradition has been. Mm. But then again, going back to our first conversation, people will make their own choices and their own decisions. As we've said, they are independent thinkers. But I do feel that there is pressure for the second generation only because they are open to these new changes, especially open to the LGBTIQ, etc. They're open to it.
You're from a Catholic background. Does it matter in multicultural Christian communities what the church says? Does it still matter?
It does matter. People are still very influenced by the rightness of this whole debate. You will know that the church themselves are opening up in this area. So people are more accepting only because it's been given the tick. The acceptance has come right from the very top, and we've seen that in Pope Francis.
Awais, we know, for example, at large mosques in Sydney, if there's been a natural disaster, for example, tens of thousands of dollars will be raised just in an hour or two in the mosque. Mm. We know that the mosque is a place of community mobilisation, support for distressed communities in Australia and overseas. Mm. Is it, though, a place of political mobilisation?
It can be. If we look at the broader scene, Western Sydney, southwestern Sydney, is much more religious. People have been, at the broader Australian level, losing faith. No faith is the largest religion after Christians, Catholics and Protestants combined. In affluent parts of Sydney, for example, or Melbourne, the loss of faith is really, really high. So in contrast, the religious following is deepening in Western Sydney, but also similar trend in Melbourne, Melbourne's multicultural areas, which means they would tend to be more conservative on some social issues and would have a different opinion.
How decisive will Western Sydney and those parts of heavily multicultural parts of say, Melbourne and Brisbane be in this election? Melissa?
Very decisive. We play a very, very important role here in Western Sydney.
Away as kingmakers?
I'm not too sure, actually, about this. I would say that one thing that I'm sure of is that they are not beholden to their own voting pattern of the past. So Labour Party tended to get their votes in the past, but they cannot depend on that anymore.
Great to have you both. Professor Awais Paracha, he's an expert in demography and urban planning at Western Sydney University. And Melissa Montero, she heads the Community Migrant Resource Centre here in Parramatta. Melissa's book, by the way, is called The Girl from Mumbai. Thank you to both of you for being on this special pre-election discussion here from Parramatta on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thank you, Andrew.
Yeah, that was a pleasure.
And you're with me, Andrew West. Now, as I said at the top of the show, there's another election taking place very soon. The number of people who get to vote is tiny, 135, but the implications are huge. And it's the vote for the next pope. Well, someone who knows the process very well, even though I should say he's never had a vote, is Father Tom Rees, Jesuit priest, commentator for the Religion News Service, and author of Inside the Vatican, The Politics and Organization of the Catholic Church. Tom, great to have you back on the show.
It's good to be with you again, Andrew.
This is a sacred process, but cardinals are not isolated figures these days. They are part of the world of realpolitik. What would be happening now, Tom?
Right now, in the time before the conclave starts, that's when the cardinals will be meeting both formally and informally. Formally, they will have what are called congregations, where each cardinal can get up and give his pitch on what he thinks are the important issues facing the church and the direction the church should go in. Then there are all sorts of informal meetings over coffee, over dinner, over drinks, where people get together and just talk about the candidates and ask each other, well, what do you think of that man? That is extremely important because some of the cardinals don't know each other. They're from all over the world, from some from very small countries that haven't traveled a lot. This is going to be a very intense time of getting to know one another.
Tom, if you are one of those cardinals that gets up in these general congregations and outlines your concerns about the church, your vision for the church, is it considered a pitch? Is it considered an audition?
No, almost everybody wants to get up and speak because even if they have no chance of becoming a cardinal, they want to influence who is chosen, and they also want to influence the man once he gets elected. You give a cleric a pulpit, they want to occupy it and speak.
We've tried to explode in the past few months, really, this myth of a neat progressive conservative divide. But is there anything, Tom, based on your understanding of previous conclaves, is there anything at all that resembles factions among the cardinals?
There's always groups that support one candidate or another. There are people who want the church to move forward more quickly. There are others who want to go slow. But the extremes don't have any chance of getting elected, either the extremes on the right or the extremes on the left, because it takes a two-thirds vote of the conclave to get elected. Sometimes what happens is there may be two leading factions, but when the voting starts, they find out that neither can get a two-thirds vote. That means they have to look around the room and find a compromise candidate, a moderate, somebody in the middle. You know, maybe he's not your first choice, but you'd certainly want him rather than somebody else. So that tends to be the process here if there's no leading candidate early in the voting.
Yeah. Well, you say that the extremes don't have a chance. What does the extreme on both the right and the left look like?
The extreme on the right would be someone who would want to get up and say the papacy of Pope Francis was a disaster. We need to go back to the old church. Nobody like that would ever be elected. The extreme on the left would be somebody who says, as soon as I'm Pope, I'm going to okay the ordination of women. We're going to change our teaching on sex. We're going to ordain married men, and we're going to give communion to anybody who walks in the door. No matter what they believe, that kind of person would not get elected either. I think it'd be more like, well, frankly, more like Pope Francis, who, although many people label him as a liberal, I think he really means more of a moderate. He was very pastoral in his approach to people, but he really didn't change doctrine all that much.
Tom, we don't, or we shouldn't, I suppose, really know what goes on inside the conclave, but Pope Francis himself gave us some indication in his recent autobiography. What did he hint at or reveal?
What he hinted at was that when the voting started, he continued on each vote to get more votes. And that is really what matters in a conclave. If you have momentum, if you continue to pick up votes every time they have a ballot, that's a good sign. Sometimes the leading candidates kind of peak and then they start to fall. Well, they don't meet the expectations that they had going into the conclave. It's the person who continues to gain votes slow and steady sometimes until people say, oh, hey, look who's gaining votes, whereas this other man is losing votes. Well, I guess his chances are over, so I'm going to jump from this candidate to the one who's gaining votes. You know, in that way, it's kind of a human process. It's all done in the midst of prayer and silence and reflection and under the gaze of that wonderful Sistine Chapel painting of Jesus coming at the Last Judgment, so they know that how they vote is going to be judged by God. So they take it very seriously.
In one of your most recent analyses for Religion News Service, I notice blending the religious and the temporal. You quote the late, great Tip O'Neill, who was a legendary speaker of the US House of Representatives, an old-fashioned kind of New Deal Catholic that probably doesn't exist much in the Democratic Party these days. But Tip O'Neill famously said, all politics is local. Why does that apply to the papal election, Tom?
Because you look for a candidate that, you know, agrees with your views on the church, and you also look for a candidate who you have a good relationship with, you know, you'll be able to talk to and get in to see when he becomes Pope. But the third thing you look for is somebody who will be well received in your part of the world, in your country. You don't want somebody who people will say, oh my God, why did they elect him? So let me give you an example. In the United States and in Australia, if someone was elected Pope who said, oh, the sex abuse crisis is just a creation of the media, that would be an absolute disaster for the church in the United States and Australia. You don't want that. On the other hand, a cardinal from a predominantly Muslim country doesn't want a Pope to get up and say something really stupid about Muslims. The cardinals from Africa clearly don't want to elect somebody with a gay agenda, what they would consider a gay agenda. They weren't happy with some of the things Pope Francis did. Each part of the world has some issues that are particular to them that they are concerned about.
In some ways, Pope Francis became the foil to Donald Trump. He spoke with an authority that perhaps other elected politicians didn't. Is the presence of Trump and his agenda, nationalist agenda, something that the cardinals will be thinking about?
Certainly, the cardinals are not going to elect somebody who Donald Trump likes. I think the chances of that are pretty slim. They will look for someone who will continue Pope Francis's prophetic speaking out for the poor, for the marginalized, for the migrants, the refugees, for the environment. Those are issues that are at the heart of the gospel and our vision of human dignity and the respect that all people deserve. You can have those kind of positions, but can you articulate them as well as Pope Francis did? I mean, he was able to do that not just in words, but also in action that showed the world that we should be concerned about this, that we should be, and using language like we should be building bridges rather than walls.
I mean, obviously, some of those who have spoken out most loudly against Donald Trump have been American cardinals. Is it now beyond the realm of possibility that an American could become Pope?
I don't think an American could become Pope because of the reaction of the rest of the world to that. I mean, in the global South, if an American was elected Pope, they would be convinced that the CIA fixed the election or Wall Street bought the election. You know, the United States is not well perceived around the world today. I think that would be pretty slim.
Father Tom Rees, Jesuit priest, commentator for the Religion News Service, and the author of Inside the Vatican, The Politics and Organization of the Catholic Church. Tom, thanks for coming back to the program.
Good to be with you.
And that's it for this episode from Parramatta Square. A big thanks to Mandy Roberts and our audio panel beater, Roy Huberman. I'm Andrew West. Join us again for the Religion and Ethics Report.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.